listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. This is author Cal Wilson. Welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. On today's episode, what I'm going to do is talk about my beliefs as to why I believe that what's going on in Venezuela very well could happen here in the United States. For reasons I'll go into later, it's been kind of a frustrating episode to put together, but I've got a couple of housekeeping matters to get to first. Number one is I'm just finishing up the sequel to a book I wrote a couple summers ago that was named EMP, The End of the Grid as We Know It. And it's amazing to me how many tiny little details have to be taken care of in this sequel book and how much time it all takes. After I make my various corrections and inserts and take stuff out, that kind of thing, I try to have it edited again, just make sure that it's polished. I'm going to try to get this book out by, well, it's almost October right now, but hopefully sometime in November. This book is way overdue. You know, I listen to prepper podcasts, but I also listen to several author podcasts out there, and it's kind of amazing. The talk among authors is, oh, I can write 1,000 words a day. You know, and then somebody says, oh, I can write 2,000 words a day. And then somebody else says, well, I've got this speech-to-text program, so I can crank out 10,000 words a day. I can't do it. The best I can do is write a chapter every week. And then I spend like another week polishing it up and adding and subtracting to it. So I guess it's just a fact of life. It just takes me longer to write a book. Okay, another thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, by the way, and the upshot for this is I've been writing this book and polishing it and so forth, and I'm going to try to get it out in November. It might cause me to delay my next episode. It surely did cause me to delay this episode. So try to be patient if you could. Another thing I wanted to mention, speaking of books, there's a book I wrote about a year ago called Dirt Cheap Valuable Survival Retreat, and I have not been marketing that book at all, but lately the sales have picked up, and I don't know who out there is talking up this book or anything. It's certainly not me. I feel it's a great book, but it's a fact of life with book selling. You have to do a little bit of marketing, which I haven't been doing for this book. So it's pretty mysterious as to why this book is selling, at least as it is. It's basically, if you were born and raised in the city and you've wondered, I wonder what it's like to even think about or discuss the topic of getting a survival retreat way out in the country, then this book is for you. And I'm a lawyer, and there's some legal issues that I discuss in this book, and there's some real estate issues that I discuss in this book, too. And I go into my own experiences having my own survival retreat in this book, and stuff that I've done wrong that I would change if I had to do it all over again, and some things that I did right just by accident. I start off the book by talking about how you're very much liable to have what I call a reverse sticker shock. If you've been born and raised in cities, in densely populated areas, and then you drive an hour and a half or 2 hours outside of the city you're from, and you look around at 20 to 50 to 100 acres, you'll be amazed at how affordable it all is. And I call that reverse sticker shock. And I go into several areas within 100 miles of a city, you know, Denver, Seattle, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Houston, Los Angeles, and they all have a reverse sticker shock. I list the average that I have found in a certain area, and you'd be amazed at how inexpensive it is. At the same time, I included this part, and I'm just going to go ahead and read it at the end of chapter one. It's called Have a Plan B. And I was trying to find a royalty-free photo of Bob Hope to include in here. I could not find it, so I didn't put one in here. But let me read this secondary consideration to getting a survival retreat. There's another consideration out there, not just surviving the end of the world. If the end of the world does not happen, then this might be a good investment for you longer term. So here's what I call have a plan B. In all of life's endeavors, it is good to have a plan B so that if you are unsuccessful at what you try to do, there will be a backup plan to still make your actions worthwhile. You know, some way of breaking even or even getting ahead a different way if you are not successful your first approach. When it comes to buying a survival retreat, keep in mind that if this property is never needed for its intended purpose, in other words, if you never need to escape a societal collapse, the property may still be valuable someday as an investment property. In fact, it could be that someday the property you had intended to be a retreat property becomes a large part of your net worth in a society that is not collapsed. I would encourage you to keep this in mind. There's no way of predicting the future, and the relative stability that our country has known for many years may very well continue. Who knows? Society might not collapse as planned. Keep this in mind when you shop for your retreat property. Think about buying a property in a location where it might someday appreciate in value, so you can sell it if you don't have to survive on it. Where to buy such a property? Many books, seminars, and college courses, each with a cost of their own, have sought to answer this very question. And of course, such an in-depth treatment would be outside the scope of a book on survival retreats. But here is a success story from a person everyone knows, Bob Hope. Throughout his entertainment career, Bob Hope invested his acting income in real estate on the outskirts of communities that were growing. At one point, Hope owned thousands of acres in Malibu, Beverly Hills, and Palm Springs, California, and also in Phoenix, Arizona. All of these properties were bought at a time when these communities were not widely known or even inhabited. In 1939, Hope bought a house on 5 acres in Toluca Lake, California, at a time when Toluca Lake was just a dusty, remote location about 20 miles north of Hollywood. Nowadays, Toluca Lake is surrounded by the suburbia of the San Fernando Valley area of Los Angeles, and Bob Hope's house was recently listed for sale there for $12 million. If Bob Hope were alive today, a prepper of modest means like you and I, and looking for a retreat property, he would probably look for some property that had all the qualities necessary to sustain him and his family in case of a societal collapse. But he would also make sure that his property would be in an area of the country with good growth potential. That way, if society stayed intact, he would have a backup plan to sell the property for a nice profit. Also, as he signed the closing paperwork that formalized his nice profit in selling the property, he would probably be singing, "Thanks for the memory," to himself. I call this Plan B for Bob Hope. Buy a good survival retreat that has all the qualities described in this book outside of a growing metropolitan area. If the property is never needed as a retreat location, someday you could sell it for a big profit. And that was from the end of chapter 1 in my book that was entitled Dirt Cheap Viable Survival Retreat. And I feel strongly about that by virtue of the fact that you're listening to this podcast, you have some doubts as to whether society will collapse, as do I. And so, therefore, you would think it's a smart idea to have a survival retreat out in the country. On the other hand, if it doesn't happen as planned, as if society goes on and you never need a survival retreat, then you need to have that backup plan. You need to have a well-situated and well-located survival retreat property that someday, who knows, 20, 30, 40 years from now, you can sell that for a pretty good profit. Anyway, I bring that up because that book is selling moderately well, and I'm still surprised it's selling at all in light of the fact I'm not really promoting it, aside from this very podcast. So that might change. There's another book out there that I have bought, and now that I've finished writing my book on this subject, there's another book on the same subject. It's called Going Off the Grid by Gary Collins, and it covers a lot of the similar subjects. And it looks to be a well-written book, and I would recommend, if you're interested in exploring the possibility of buying a survival retreat, that you buy my book as well as this other book. Again, it's called Going Off the Grid by Gary Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S. I'll have a link in the show notes here. Okay, now on to the subject of this podcast, which is Venezuela, and how I believe Venezuela could very well happen here in the United States. And let me start this off by saying, when we're talking about Venezuela, it's not just another third world country. Venezuela is an extremely important country. By most accounts, Venezuela is sitting on the number one or number two or number three supply of oil in the whole world. In the whole world, more than Saudi Arabia, more than Russia, more than Nigeria, whatever. In the whole world, it's way up there. Number one, number two, there's no way to say for sure it's number one or number two, whatever. But the people out there who know this subject feel that Venezuela is number one or number two. So it's not just another third world country. It should be an extremely wealthy country. And in the past, at different times, it has been. So that's why it's so important as to what's going on in Venezuela, that we're not just talking about another third world country. We're talking about Venezuela, which is possibly number one as far as sitting on how much oil they have. So when Venezuela is such a miserable country and so poor nowadays, and people are rummaging through trash dumps looking for food to eat, and in the hospitals, they don't even feed their patients there. They don't even have the medicines to care for their patients there. Brownouts in all parts of Venezuela are routine. Water doesn't run all the time. Part of my frustration in putting this episode together is the fact that the internet there in Venezuela is so spotty. I was not able to get a Skype connection going with anybody. Here's what I did. If you look on the internet, you can shop around for people who will build a website for you, people who will do English to Spanish translation. That's what I did. A doctor in Venezuela did that for me on one of my books. Some people on the internet will do graphic design for you. They will help you design a brochure or whatever. And you can look up and find out where these people are. In this situation, I have looked for those people who live in Venezuela. And I've contacted them and I've told them, hey, I'm not in the market for a graphic design or translation services or whatever. I'm doing a podcast on the conditions inside Venezuela today. And like I said, I was hoping to get a Skype connection, but that was not possible. So what I did is I proposed, let me pay you, Mr. Graphic Designer or Translator or whatever, web page designer, let me just pay you for your time. I won't mention your name. And as a resident and citizen of Venezuela, what I'd like you to do is just answer several questions that I have for you and just record yourself talking, you know, an MP3 file, and then email it to me. I won't mention your name. I don't think they really cared. So that's what I did for this episode. And I basically asked these people four questions. Four questions. Number one, what is it really like in Venezuela today? I mean, just forget about the newspaper accounts. What does your day-to-day life inside Venezuela, what's that really like? Number two, what did Hugo Chavez and his followers tell Venezuelans in order to get Venezuelans to vote for them in the late 90s. Hugo Chavez might not have said he's a socialist, but everybody agrees he's a socialist, and he and his successor are socialist leaders in Venezuela, and that's why it's such a toilet over there right now. So that was the second question. Number three, the third question, if you could go back in time before everything got really bad in Venezuela, and you could stockpile anything that would make your life in 2018 Venezuela any better? What would you stockpile and bring back with you? Most of the time, the answer was dollars. That translates, by the way, for us, I think that means junk silver and smaller denominations of gold or silver, that we can keep that and it will keep its value. And 20 years into a societal collapse, we'll still be able to buy stuff. That's what I take from that answer. And the fourth question is, what are your immediate plans? And almost all of them said they plan to leave, as have about 10% of Venezuela. Almost 10% of Venezuela has just left. Most of those people are camping out in refugee camps along the Brazilian or Colombian borders. But there you have it. Now, my frustration, aside from not having a Skype connection, where I think that would have been important because I could ask follow-up questions, but I was not able to do that. The main frustration I have with these audio recordings is that just by virtue of the fact that these are people who are still inside Venezuela, they tend to have a little bit of hope that things will either get better or stop getting so bad, which is confusing to me because I'm reading the news about Venezuela. It's always bad, bad news. Let me see if I can get that. I had a list of news items of Venezuela. The point is, these people who responded to me are either just not that smart, or they don't just see the way things are going. One guy made the comment that some stores out there just charge too much. Now, see, that's when a Skype connection would have been great. A store charging too much, really? What do you think should be done about that store that's charging too much? And the way that guy was talking, you'd think he would say something like, well, the government needs to take over that store and arrest the managers of that store. He didn't say that, but that was kind of the feeling I got with that guy. Whereas a capitalist would say, oh, there's a store that's charging too much? No problem. Encourage a competing store to open up just right down the street. You know, capitalism 101, just encourage competition, and then the consumer will benefit, the stores will benefit. It's just a win-win situation with capitalism. If I were in Venezuela today and I noticed a store that was charging, quote-unquote, too much for food or basic necessities, I would encourage the government to just come out with an announcement. Announce that they are streamlining the permit process to open up a competing store. And the government should say, okay, I tell you what, we're going to make the permit process so easy. You can just rent a container ship and float that into some other country, stock it up with goods at some discount store or whatever, bring it back and open up a store even at the docks. You can open a warehouse store at the shipping docks, you know? That would be just totally simple. And it's not a silly example. You know, I remember a few years ago, I was on a missionary trip in middle of nowhere in Baja, Mexico. And I went to a little town and went to a small grocery store. I remember I was looking around and I was just thinking to myself, where have I seen all this stuff before? Why does it look so familiar? And then I realized, oh, it's all from Costco here down in Mexico. And I found out later that the owner of that grocery store, and it was about two or three times the size of a typical 7-Eleven. It wasn't huge, but what he normally did is he rented an 18-wheeler and a driver, and they'd cross the border into San Diego and just go to a Costco, fill up that 18-wheeler and drive it back and sell everything there for their cost plus 20% or whatever. And that's why that store I was in the middle of nowhere in Mexico was filled with Costco stuff. But see, there's an incentive. That store owner had to put a little bit of money up front, but was selling a lot of stuff just at a profit. The consumers were happy. They would not have gotten this stuff otherwise. Anyway, that's how you handle a situation where a store is charging, quote unquote, too much for whatever they're selling. Is you encourage competition. But apparently that's the last thing on everybody's mind in Venezuela right now. try to think of the one Hispanic group out there that is so completely anti-communist. It's the Cubans in Miami, because they've seen a disaster that communism is and the totalitarianism that it becomes, and they've skedaddled out of Cuba, and now they are completely and totally anti-communist in Miami. That's what I thought I would get some recordings from. But apparently, if you're still living in Venezuela today, you have this hope that maybe things will not be getting so bad, or maybe things get a little bit better. There's one of these people who kind of doesn't really put two and two together. He just kind of has this attitude, the economy's going through a tough spell, yeah. One guy said his immediate plans are to leave Venezuela, but he wants to save up money in order to do it first. Again, a Skype connection would have been great. I could say, dude, save up? What are you talking about? You're living in Venezuela right now. Anyway, let me go over the list of things I've been keeping track of, how bad things are in Venezuela. GDP growth, the economy contracted 13% in 2017, on top of a 17% contraction in 2016. Unemployment is 26%. I think it's even a lot higher than that. Poverty rate is 87%. Poverty is defined as when people are not able to afford just the bare necessities for themselves and their family. 87%. Inflation is around 1,000,000%. That's where you can just write off the currency. Just forget it. It's totally worthless. Now, here's a new measurement of how bad things can get in a country. Weight loss. The typical Venezuelan in 2017 lost 24 pounds. And this was after losing 19 pounds per person in 2016. The Caracas murder rate is astronomical, 120 per 100,000. The worst in the world. Diseases are making a comeback here. Malaria, tuberculosis, Zika, measles reappearing. Anytime you read about how bad things are in Venezuela, if it's a liberal news outlet, they will talk about how the price of oil has gotten really low, or just vague economic problems. And one of the people I've gotten the recordings from, one of the women, said that the hard times, and this was a good point she made, the hard times in Venezuela didn't just start in the late 90s, they began in the early 90s. And sure enough, I did look up the price of oil, and it was really low throughout most of the 90s. And I'm talking like $10 to $30 a barrel, fluctuating back and forth. Longer term, the chart was generally higher than that, and then it came down throughout almost the whole 90s, and it was very low. And don't quote me on this, but I think it's between $80 and $100 a barrel right now. So when a oil-centric country like Venezuela lives a whole decade of very low oil prices like it did in the 90s, well, sure enough, there were some hard economic times in the 90s. And that's when this one woman made some good sense that whenever there's any hard times in a country, it's easy for somebody to campaign and say, well, I will make things a whole lot better and I'll sock it to those rich people if you elect me. And sure enough, that's what Hugo Chavez, that's how he campaigned in the late 90s. And by the way, I want to mention another thing. Marxism is when the government owns the means of production. If there's a store in town in a communist country, no problem, it's owned by the government. It's kind of a fine line when a country calls itself socialist. Sometimes that means that they're just really high taxes and huge government benefits. Sometimes the taxes are so high, it might as well be a Marxist country. So that's why I think that Venezuela, even if it's not calling itself Marxist, it's effectively a Marxist country right now. And that's why it's such a disaster. Okay, before I get into playing these MP3 audios, let me tell you a story about what happened to me a couple months ago. And this kind of explains why I believe Venezuela could happen here in the United States someday. Okay. I was going to court, and it was afternoon court appearance. And the judge had not yet made it back to the courthouse. He was late for lunch or finishing the back nine or whatever. So the courtroom was closed, but they were letting attorneys in. They were letting the court staff in. There was a court reporter ready to go. Various attorneys were all in there just sitting around chatting. There was a Spanish-speaking interpreter, a woman I knew from like 20 years now. And she's, I won't mention her name, obviously, but she's a few years older than me, kind of. She's always been very friendly, kind of matronly. And I think the legal profession in general, you know, everybody is pretty much on their good behavior in situations like this. We're just kind of sitting around chatting, keeping the conversation non-controversial. You know, they're talking about the weather, they're talking about their families and complaining about their son's college tuition, stuff like that. I'm one of the few conservative slash libertarian attorneys out there, and I can count on one hand the others, but I appreciate that they don't just dive right into politics. So I was just sitting around chatting, and this Spanish interpreter woman, just a real friendly woman, from I've known her from way back. A few years ago, she had to have one of her dogs put down, and so did I. And so maybe about 5 years ago, we kind of commiserated for a few minutes there in court and showed photos. And so anyway, a really nice person, nice person. I don't know how the subject got to President Nixon. In fact, it might have been some reference to Nixon being on that show Laugh-In, and how we got onto that subject, I have no idea. But she said something like, yeah, he was a pretty intense guy. And I said, yeah, he was anti-communist before it was cool. And that was probably a mistake. And then she said something like, oh, well, I've always thought that there are just some parts of the world where, you know, you just can't run the place unless it's a communist government. And I've heard that before. But she says, you know, like Scandinavia, those places are communist and they're such great countries and the standard of living is so great. And I said, well, you know, it's not exactly communist. If you open a business there and make a profit in Scandinavia, you can still get to keep your profit. Oh, well, you know, she changes the subject to Venezuela and she says, oh, like all those very, very wealthy people at the top of the country in Venezuela, and the whole country is really poor. There was no other way to run Venezuela besides having a communist government there. And I said, well, now it's a whole different group of people, and they're even richer than anyone was before, and the rest of the country is even poorer, even more poor than they ever were. Oh, well. And she says, you know, like the miracle of the healthcare system that they have in Cuba. And I said, you don't really believe that, do you? I mean, nobody goes to Cuba to get health care. In fact, if they could, everybody, you know, would leave Cuba for health care. And speaking of communists, you know, Fidel Castro was one of the world's wealthiest people when he died. That's what happens in communist countries, is that the leadership gets to be extremely wealthy while everybody else is pretty poor and miserable. And at that point, I just thought, oh, you know, I'm not really getting anywhere, and she's probably getting annoyed. So I tried changing the subject away from politics, and she said something like, oh, well, I just like all those poor people out there and hungry. I just like to feed them all and to give them all food and shelter and clothing and just make sure that they're all taken care of. And then she said, I'm a Bernie bro, and I'm a strong believer in a good old-fashioned safety net. And I just thought, you know, well, that makes perfect sense, because that's what, I mean, not that this woman was a recent college graduate or anything, but that's the attitude out there, that if you're just a nice person, you're a socialist, or you're in favor of socking it to those awful, evil, rich capitalist people, and you want to give money to poor people just because you're a friendly person. The reality is there's no crueler thing you can do to a whole group of people than have a socialist or Marxist government in charge of them. People are willing still to this day to risk their life to escape Cuba. And like I said, about 10% of Venezuela has left. I think that's going to continue a whole lot more than that. But I think it's just cruel to inflict Marxism on a whole country. That's a cruel thing to do. But yet, that's what's being taught. If you watch movies, if you watch the mainstream news, just everybody talks about what a kind person you are if you're a socialist. So that's why I think Venezuela very well could happen here in the United States someday. So anyway, with that having been said, let me get on to these recordings that I got from people inside Venezuela. I think it will be illuminating. I think if I had to do this again, I'd probably try to find people who have left Venezuela instead of those who are still inside Venezuela. But whatever, I still think this will be educational. So with that having been said, let's get on with these recordings from inside Venezuela today.
Life in here is difficult, as you could have heard, about the food. If you go out to buy some for your home, and you're lucky enough to find milk, eggs, vegetable oil, and flour, you should buy it, because you don't know where you're gonna find it again in the future. The prices of things are dollar relatable, and every time that President Maduro comes out in a speech saying that the salary will be raised, private companies have to increase the prices of their items so they can pay the salary that Maduro spoke of. You don't have water the 24 hours of the day. Usually, it's rationed in your area. I had the opportunity to stay 4 days in Margarita, and I heard the people that actually live there that they have to wait around 15 days so they can fill up their water tanks and administrate them until the water comes again. About the medicine, you usually don't find what you are searching, and if you do, the price is really high. So families rely on family members that are out of the country, so they can send the medicine to them. And if you don't have this as an option, you will have to try your luck in pharmacies. But as I said earlier, they are really hard to find. There are no riots these days, I haven't heard of them at least. But last year, Venezuela entered a season where riots was a common scene in your day routine. And people thought that this time we were going to finally finish this sad situation, but the government repressed in such a way that it was impossible to achieve this. Many lives were sacrificed in these days. People that died because of the violence from the government anti-riot authorities will never be forgotten by the students that went out to the streets to fight for what they loved, their country. I don't trust any information that comes out in TV because they are usually manipulated. The violence is still present every time a rob appears. Could be manifested from the thief himself or the crowd trying to punish him for robbery. The authorities here are the first one to help the thief. You don't know if they take the thief to release him in the streets not much later, or if they do take him into jail, or even if he's a member of the crew. The hyperinflation is a real thing. The 20th of August, President Maduro took off 5 zeros of the national currency and named the new currency as Bolívar Soberano. And not much earlier, they have already took off 3 zeros from Bolívares to Bolívares Fuertes, strong Bolívares in English. To me, it's ridiculous. So if you think about it, in not less than 10 years, they have taken out 8 zeros out of the prices so they can hide the real economic situation. Well, it's a fusion of many things. One of them is that we don't have much national production. Even with Polar Company, that gives a lot of food to Venezuela, with their products, we need more national production so we don't need to import them. The corruption in main heads of the government should be another one. We often see a lot of ongoing projects paid by the government that they don't finish. And why is that? If it's paid by the government, why they don't finish the projects that they proposed? And it's worldwide known that Diosdado Cabello is involved in narcotraffic business, and I suspect there are more like him in the government. Another thing is that there's a foreign exchange control that prevents people from having an exact rate for imported products, and many people take advantage of this by overvaluing said products so the prices of almost everything rises up. Chavez were involved in many in-time movements like Agricultural Action, Fifth Republic movement, which evolved to what we know now as United Socialist Party of Venezuela, PSUV, and this gave him a lot of popularity in a sector that he called patriotic pole. Also, Chavez participated in a coup that happened in the night of the 3rd of February to the sunrise of the 4th of February. That failed. That's where his name started bouncing heads of the Venezuelans. Also, Caldera's second government left Venezuela without a secure option for the selection afterwards, because nor AD or COPEI gave a solution to the economic crisis that Venezuelans were facing in that moment with the closure of the Banco Latino. And these two last political parties were the competition, so that gave an open field to Chavez to win the elections with a devastating result. Almost 50% of the country voted for Chavez. Speaking of gluttony, I would buy a lot of pirulín. That's a grocery that drives me crazy. But being realistic, I would say lots of flour pan. That's the one we use to make arepas. If you haven't heard of them, you should go out now and get one. You can eat them for breakfast, lunch, or even dinner, and you can fill it up with almost anything, and it will taste well. Another thing that I will buy, it's vegetable oil, meat, chicken, tomato sauce, mayonnaise, mustard, and not speaking of food, then it would be toilet paper, healthcare products like toothpaste, soaps, shampoo, washing detergents, spare parts for cars, and any kind of maintenance products. Those are all kinda rare to get now these days, and if you find them, as I said earlier, the price is ridiculous. Also, I would buy lots of medicine such as acetaminophen, ibuprofen, anti-allergics, etc. Another thing that I would buy is light bulbs. They are hard to find and they tend to break down since we have these lights off events. That's something I forgot to mention in the first question. If you search for explosiones en Maracaibo in YouTube, I'm sure you'll find some of the last events that went off there. And let me tell you something. It's something horrible. People panicking in the streets, the sky covered with sparks because of the light streets exploding, and many random explosions around. It's something horrible. You should watch it and see what I'm talking about. Well, my plan is to leave as soon as I can, but I need to make money first, so I don't land in a place without hopes of getting better. I need to be sure that where I'm going, I will be living at least for a month without worrying about the money. And after I get into that place, that different country, I will work a lot to get a better quality of living. At least it should be better than here. Not making long queues to buy anything that you want, and to trust authorities and not the contrary. To have a job that pays well and actually make a living out of my salary. And perhaps, if everything is going well, a postgrad in my area. And maybe, in the future for vacation, visit Venezuela again and see my family and the few friends that I will leave here. That's my plan for the future.
First question. What are things really like in Venezuela today? Our life had turned very difficult. Hospitals doesn't work. Even we can't find medicines. Obviously, if you get sick, it's a big problem. It doesn't matter if it is just a simple flu. You can die because there are any medical supplies. And the food, it's terrible expensive. So it's difficult to buy food because salaries are very low. One Venezuela earns is less than a dollar each month. It doesn't matter in which company do you work, you always will get the same payment. If you realize that you are pregnant, you will be crazy. Have a baby with this economical situation is terrible. There is not even milk, not sweating bands, not food. Babies suffer a lot because they cannot have a normal medical attention or a normal diet. Recently, people started to fight in the streets, and that was worse because a lot of people died. and we can't go out in those days. Electricity and public service fails a lot. Most of the time, we don't have water at home, only in some case, once a week. But I think that the most bad thing is the public transportation. Every day becomes worse. The subway, it's a chaos. You even can have an accident there. Everyone is pushed away. And it's very complicated go to work or school. We walk long distance. And sometimes we are not sure of how we are going to return home. Of course, if you have a car, you're safe. But then the problem is how you're gonna keep that car working. Mechanic service and car parts are very expensive. Some Venezuelans leave to another country, leaving their houses, their works, their family. This situation has separated many families, but the ones who leave can help their family by sending money to them. It appears amazing, but people keep making their life instead of all. Everyone goes to school, work, they buy, they die, they get married. Life is normal, or maybe not. But I guess that now all of this has become to be part of our life, of our daily routine. Second question. What were Venezuelans told before Hugo Chavez was elected in order to get people to vote for him? Well, that's a long story, but I guess everything starts in 1989. There were a lot of missing basic articles and the price of gay soul was increased. People get very angry. And in that particular moment happened what we call El Caracazo. It was a terrible turbulence. A lot of supermarkets and commercial business were stolen because masses of people went out and as they don't have food or money, they decided to steal them from the supermarkets and stores. After that, there was an attack to the government released by Chavez in 1992. He went to jail, but he got out. And after that, he presented himself as a presidential candidate. Basically, he won the elections because of two facts. First, people used to have everything, but they were not happy with the government. This is a very common attitude towards Venezuela because every elections I have seen in my life, people are never satisfied with the results. There are a lot of rumors of corruption behind those election results. And as a result, of course, people want something different. Guess everyone was tired of things going wrong, and he appears as a hero with a lot of promises. And that brings me to the point number two. He was different from the presidents that ruled before. He broke all the patterns. He appears on TV with casual clothing, he jokes on TV, and disrespects rich people, the ones who ruled before. Chavez brings another different way of government, and that sounds engaging. Finally, he stole the heart of the poor people like some kind of Robin Hood. Who doesn't love that? A man saving people in need. Well, not everyone loved him, but the greatest part of the population were poor, and he has persuaded them. He keeps the advantage, and guess that's how people was cheated. Third question. If you could go back in time to yourself in 1998, when all this started, what item or items would you get a lot of so that you will better be able to survive 2018? Well, that's a good question. I think if I can go back in time, first thing I will do is to keep all the dollars that I can and maybe buy a lot of clothes for the future. I think I need it. And I don't know, maybe try to advise people or even try to leave the country. I don't know for sure. But I guess the most important thing will be save dollars and invest in them. Today in Venezuela, dollars are valuable.
What is life like in Venezuela today? Well, living in Venezuela today is like living without knowing what's going on next. The superinflation that we have here is increasing every day, that you don't know how much will you spend in your basic needs weekly. We have a big insecurity problem too. The police and security departments are corrupted, and criminals feel free to do what they want and where they want. The basic service and needs aren't covered by the government, like we don't have electricity every day, we don't have water, and in the hospitals you can find medicines. For example, you go to a bakery and you can't find bread in the bakery. The supermarkets are empty. There is a big problem with the gas. And we are a country that produces petroleum and gas, and we don't have gas in our country. What else? There is too many people eating and getting food from the trash, and it's not people that you look them like homeless. It's people that maybe they has house, they has a job, but they can't afford food. They can buy enough food to maintain a family. Another big problem is that the earnings per month for one people is like $1. Some people earn less than $1. And this is a big problem. In general, living in Venezuela is living without your basic needs, and that is living without your basic needs. The main causes of economic problems in Venezuela, for sure, the economic decisions and the economic plans of the government, like the currency block. You know that we in Venezuela, we can't get another currency that is not ours, that is not Bolivar's, and that makes a black market appear, and you can find, for example, dollars in the price, in the correct price. Dollars here can be the rate, the legal rate for the exchange, 16 bolivares, and you can find it in the street like 200 bolivares, 2000 bolivares. That's crazy. And for sure, the corruptions in all departments of the government is incredible. Many people without any studies or any preparation are in charge of important positions on the government, and it's more than what they steal, than what they do. What were Venezuelans told to get them vote for Hugo Chavez and the socialism? Well, the Hugo Chavez campaign and propaganda was totally a lie. They told to the Venezuelans that the country will change for good, that the government was going to make sure that all the Venezuelans' families will, and the different social strata will have the same opportunities and possibilities. What nowadays, like more than 18 years later, is not happening. It's still not happening. And I think that will never happen. Also, they like saying that they will not apply a socialist regime, and they, for example, they say that they will never take your the private companies and that, and less than 5 years later of that, they took almost all the private industry and take for the government. They took advantage of the poor people that have nothing in that year and make a false promise to them. Nowadays, most of that people is against the government. Will you accumulate or stockpile to help you surviving in Venezuela in 2018? Well, this one is the easier one to answer. And if you ask this question to any Venezuelan, they will say that they accumulate dollars, because nowadays here in Venezuela, the only way to have a little escape from the reality is having or earning dollars, because the overpricing on all the service and the food, the medicines, the basic needs, the only way to avoid not having your basic needs is having dollars. What are your plans for the future? Well, my plans for the future is like the plan of every young people in Venezuela. The only solution that we have now is leaving the country, full of hope that someday we can back and live a normal life. Because now if you want to buy a house, your own house, or buy a car, you have to work more than 10 years to get that car without spending any bolivar in another thing. It's like a crazy situation for us, the young people. And like most of the family, the plans is that the younger people of the family go to another country, and then they can send some money to the other peoples or the other members of the family to help them survive in Venezuela.
Okay, so there you have it, everyone. Some audio recordings from people inside of Venezuela today. And like I said, I'm pretty underwhelmed with this group of people. There appears to be no sense of urgency. There's quite a bit of complacency there. It's kind of bizarre to listen to this. These people are living right in the middle of a country that I believe is close on its way to total collapse, and they really don't appear to be that concerned with it all. I guess they're just simple folk. Maybe they're graphic design artists. Their heads are too busy down in their computer systems to worry about what's going on just outside their door. It's really strange. I've sensed more urgency among American environmentalists who are trying to ban straws than I have of listening to these people. It's really pretty strange. There's no lessons learned here. It's kind of strange. But the one thing I did learn that I thought was interesting was how most of them said if they could stockpile something that would help them survive today, it would be dollars. And of course, that's a good idea for us here in the United States to stockpile physical dollars in smaller denominations. Smaller denominations meaning if we wind up in a barter situation, you don't have to bother with getting change. If you can imagine going to a barter center with a brick of gold, you can buy whatever, but you're not going to get any change from that. So that's why smaller denominations are important. So yeah, stockpiling dollars would be a good idea, but also for those of us in the United States, if you're worried that someday the dollar might totally collapse and become worthless, just like the currency in Venezuela, then what you'd want to do is stockpile so-called junk silver. And junk silver is silver coins like dimes and quarters that have the year 1964 or older. And that way, you know that that coin is 90%+ real silver. It's not the very small amount of silver that's in the coinage today. So yeah, 1964 or older dimes and quarters are the way to go. It's kind of bizarre listening to these people inside Venezuela today, because I firmly believe, and I'd be overjoyed if I was wrong, but I think that Venezuela is about to become a failed state. Now, what is a failed state? And let me just say that I think the death knell was when it came out that there's 1,000,000%. You might as well just forget about the local currency. There is no local currency. And when there's no local currency, you know, how does a power company, for example, pay its bills? Well, it doesn't. So it shuts down. How about the local municipal water providing company? How does that company pay its bills? Well, it doesn't. So it shuts down. How about driving across town or across the country in Venezuela? How does a local gas station pay its bills? Well, it doesn't. So it shuts down. And pretty soon, what's going to happen is various parts of Venezuela will become ruled by local warlords or paramilitary groups. And nobody's going to bother thinking longer term. You're not going to have farmers planting a crop in anticipation of harvesting it in 4 months. You know, people are more interested in whether they're going to be able to eat in the next 24 hours. And in a failed state, if you can use your gun, well, then you might be able to eat. If you can prostitute yourself somehow, well, you might be able to eat. If you can ingratiate yourself with the local warlord or paramilitary group somehow, then you might be able to eat. Otherwise, there's nothing to do but just try to get out. Get out of the country. And there's some movies that give you a picture of what it's like living in a failed state. Mad Max is one of them. Road Warrior, which is a classic back in the I think it was in the 80s with Mel Gibson. More recently, there was a movie called Book of Eli, E-L-I, which is a great movie, and it shows you what it's like to live in a failed state. And if you want to just Google the term failed state, you know, some examples are Somalia today or Libya, where pretty much there is no government. There's a whole bunch of different warlords and their people who work for them. But nobody's bothering with any kind of long-term plans, because there is no long-term in a failed state. So that's why it's a real head-scratcher to listen to these people I managed to find who are living in Venezuela today. I think the refugee crisis, I mentioned 10% of the country has left Venezuela. I think that's just a drop in the bucket. I mean, unless things drastically change fast in Venezuela, like I said, with the currency, there is no currency, so everything's bartered. There's no power company. There's nothing. There's nothing. I mean, it's going to be hard for the military to pay their salaries there. I don't know how that's going to work, but maybe the military is just going to start dividing up the country and saying, okay, you're in charge of that part, I'm in charge of this part over here, and they're just going to loot as best they can to stay alive. But I think the refugee crisis is going to be getting a whole lot worse. And unlike Cuba, which doesn't allow people to leave, so far it sounds like Venezuela is allowing people to leave, which is great. The problem is, what about countries outside of Venezuela? You know, I think it's Peru, there's Colombia and Venezuela. At some point, they're going to say, okay, enough. No more people allowed crossing this bridge or whatever. No other people allowed to cross the border into our country. And that's going to become really ugly there. So the refugee crisis is going to get a whole lot worse. So in light of all this, I think it's just, within a year, Venezuela is going to totally collapse. So how can you help? And if you're like our family, we have tithe money, we give to various charities. I have found a handful of charities that I'm going to list here. And by the way, anytime somebody makes a pitch for a charity or anytime you're tempted to give to a charity, it's a good idea to look up that charity on charitynavigator.org. You know, I was at Panda Express a few days ago. Oh, would you like to contribute to a children's hospital? Well, when somebody says that, the implication is 100% of your money goes to that children's hospital. So I quickly looked it up on Charity Navigator and did not find that it was that great of a charity. Can't remember the details, but, and just for a laugh, you can always look up the Clinton Foundation. That has a low ranking. There are a number of charities out there where it's really a way for some people to get rich, and shame on them, you know. But there are some charities out there, wherever you give money to a charity, whether it's Venezuela or whatever, look them up on Charity Navigator, and you'll find out whether the administrative costs are sky high or not. Anyway, I found a handful of good charities that will help people in Venezuela or help refugees on the Venezuelan border. And I'm going to print those in the show notes. Otherwise, I hope that you found this episode of the Survival in Motion podcast educational and informative. Maybe not in the way that you thought it would be, but I hope you enjoyed it and found it informative. If I hear the music, that means our time is up. Thank you for joining me. God bless.
Of tinkling temple bells, alma mater yells.
And Cuban rum and towels from the very best hotels.
Ah, how lovely it was. Thanks for the memory of cushions on the floor, hashed with Dinty Moore, that pair of gay pajamas that you bought and never wore.
Say, by the way, whatever became of those pajamas?
Huh? We said goodbye with a highball.
Then I got as high as a steeple.
Did you?
But we were intelligent people.
No tears, no fuss. Hooray for us. Strictly entre-nous, darling, how are you?
And how are all those little dreams that never did come true?
Awfully glad I met you.
Cheerio and toodaloo.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.